Welcome to Important Not Important. My name is Quinn Emmett.
And my name is definitely Brian Colbert Kennedy. No reason to say anything else about it.
Nicely done. Nicely done. This is episode 13 with Mayor Serge Dedina of Imperial Beach, California. He is also executive director and co-founder of Wild Coast, and they work to conserve marine ecosystems. But most specifically for this little chat, Mayor Dedina was the first mayor and mayor of the first city to sue the fossil fuel companies.
No big deal.
That's right. That case is still ongoing, and a number of others have delightfully sprung up, and we're going to talk about those and also whether your community should be joining the fight.
Hint, they should be. But there's some steps to take first, obviously.
And not surprisingly, the good mayor outlines those pretty simply for us all.
Oh, yeah.
Serge isn't new at this, man. God, this is awesome. You know, it runs in the family. His old grandma basically punched Hitler.
Yeah, right in the face.
And that's all we're going to say.
Well, yeah, we'll let him take it from there. But that should excite you because his family is awesome.
Right, right. Basically, from punching Hitler to defending the ocean like Aquaman.
Oh, God, the one part where I'm so excited.
No, don't do the thing. Don't do the thing.
It's going to be good.
Yeah, people are going to be excited. They're going to really enjoy it. want to apologize for some audio quality on this one. You might not pick up on it, but my delightful OCD did.
Yeah, it wasn't up to Quinn's very high standards.
Serge had some technical issues, probably not his fault.
No, of course
we
not.
Had some technical issues, which involved Brian and I sharing a microphone like, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Clarence Clemens, but much less sexy.
It was very cute, though.
For who?
Well, for us.
For what do you mean?
For whom?
For whom?
I thought it was nice to be close to you. We're friends. We got to talk into the mic and sit next to each other. It was great.
Tier two friends.
No, nope, that's not true.
Anyways, we appreciate it. If it makes you feel any better, we were sweating our balls off because it's 78 degrees here and that's just out of control.
Oh, God. And even hotter in here without the...
Yeah, with the surface of the sun outside our windows. We got these new Target curtains.
They are very nice and they're extremely helpful. I can't imagine what the fuck it would have been like without them.
$11 fucking saved our lives today. And we can't turn on our air conditioner because now you know what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's very loud. It's way too loud. And yeah. It's right by the mic. It would be a nightmare.
Do you want to tell everybody why, despite a number of weather apps on the App Store, you chose to wear a jacket today?
I walked out of my house checking the app.
Uh-huh.
The app said it was like 60, it said 67 degrees.
It's not 67
degrees.
It's what
it said on the...
No, there's no way. But it is 5:30 right now and it's 78 degrees. Well, so there's no way at 3 o'clock.
Maybe I need to get 15 a new weather less. App.
Yeah, sounds
Quinn,
like it.
Okay. And then I thought to myself, well, I'll think ahead. And by the time I leave, it'll be colder. It won't be.
No.
Now I realize. So yes, I wore a heavier jacket than I should have.
What's your weather app?
I explained to you that the problem is I don't have a lot of jacket options right now.
And my point was, it's not about jacket options. It's you don't wear a jacket.
I didn't need one at all. Also, let me point out, Mr. I hate you when you ride a motorcycle. It's actually a little more protective to have some sort of jacket. Also, not that it's a motorcycle jacket.
I was going to say, that jacket's not members only is not protecting you from anything.
It's not a members only jacket. And it would at least save my skin from being scraped up if it was a minor accident.
Not as much as you think. What's your weather app?
I don't know. The fucking one that comes on the phone. Yahoo, I guess?
Oh, Jesus. Yahoo's not even a company anymore.
No, it's not Yahoo. It's the Weather Channel app, okay?
You got to get into Dark Sky, man.
All right. Well, yes, I clearly need to use something else.
You know how in Frozen, at the end, she puts the snowstorm cloud above?
What an amazing movie to reference from Quinn with three children to Brian with zero children.
I'm trying to explain to you how hyper-local Dark Sky is.
Oh.
She puts a snow cloud above the snowman, the Olaf, so that he doesn't melt ever, no matter what season it is. And that's basically Dark Sky, which is they're like, hey, Brian, where you're standing, it's about to rain in 10. I mean, it doesn't say rain here,
right.
5, 4, and then it fucking rains. And then they're like, hey, it's going to stop. And then it stops.
All right, I'll get Dark Sky. Is it free?
No. It costs money in man hours or female hours to make it. I think it's a dude, but I don't really understand that.
So, anyway, I like the new plants in the office.
We got some new plants.
Yeah.
The old one is on its way out. We did a pretty good job, but I abandoned it for a few months, and it turns out that's what happens.
Do you know what kind of plants these are, what their names are?
No.
Okay.
No, they said it enhances the oxygen we breathe, which I fear is, we could use that.
They look really great. When I first came in, listeners, Quinn said that they were, he said, say hello to little Brian and big Brian, but then he really let the truth out. And
I changed your name.
Really, it's Harold. Yeah. It's Harold. Yeah, Harold.
No, it's Harold Jr. and Harold 2.0.
Oh, got it. Right. Yeah. I felt good for a second.
So anyways, also baseball started.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah, super fun. You went to a game.
I did. Opening day. That was great.
Was it good? I forgot to ask.
Yeah. I mean, it's always good.
I wasn't there, so I just didn't really care that much. But I hope you had fun with your other better friend.
Brian's beard still hasn't grown back, and it makes me so upset.
I was just going to boom because I felt good about my jab, and then you went right
into
that.
And then you forgot that you look like a child molester?
Yeah, well, you know, no, child molesters have beards, man, for sure.
No, they don't. They have, like, disgusting red mustaches.
Mustaches, yeah, and glasses. Maybe they're bald. No offense to other mustache glasses wearing.
There goes three of our listeners. They're like, what the fuck, Brian?
You know what I was going to say about my facial hair was that I was sure that I was going to walk into the office today, open the door, and there was going to be my good pal and co-host, also clean shaven.
We can't both be clean shaven.
As a stand in solidarity with me.
Not going to happen.
I'm glad you did.
I'll be your phone call when you go for jail, but I'm not going that far. I'm not going to shave with you.
I'm just trying. I hate it, but I'm trying to at least be the one person who's like, no, it's fine. But yes, I also don't like it, and it's going to grow back.
If you were to go to jail.
Yeah.
What is the
likely,
thing
first
you're,
of all.
100%. What's the thing you think you're most likely to go to jail for? Go. What's your gut say?
You know what? I think it would be something. Oh, this would be it for sure. I
can't wait.
Oh my God. I have it. So specific.
Hope your mom's listening to this one. Let's
I
hear
love
it.
You, mom. So much. I was jaywalking the other day.
Check.
And which I do often. I don't know. It seems normal to me. And a cop, you know, did like the real quick, like, woo, 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 just to, like, get my attention, you know, and then I, like, looked over and, you know, he sort of just, like, gave me a look, like, you're fucking breaking the law, dude, or whatever. So in my mind, I was thinking, man, if he came over here to give me a ticket and I was just, like, in a mood that I'm often in.
Which is what?
I don't know. Sometimes I want to be combative.
Why?
I don't know. Because something pissed me off and now I'm, listen.
Talk to me about that.
I'm just answering your question, okay? We could talk about that later. I thought to myself, if he came over here and wrote me a jaywalking ticket, because they're pretty expensive. They're like hundreds of dollars. Yes, they are. I swear to God, look it up.
Hundreds, plural?
I'm going to...
We'll check back on that. We'll put it in the show notes.
Even if it's $50.
Keep going.
I'm pretty sure it's hundreds. I feel like I possibly, because I was in a snappy mood at that time, I would have been a smart ass.
Well, what's going to cost you hundreds of dollars isn't the $50 jaywalking ticket. It's fucking resisting arrest.
Unexplained
combative mood.
Yeah, that's right. That is what I think it would be something silly like that, because I would not be able to contain my, like, you know, bad attitude because something dumb pissed me off, and it would be like at a cop who is trying to give me a ticket, and then I tell him like, oh, good job, buddy. Is this what you got into the force for? Like something real dumb. And then I would like rip the ticket up in front of him and then he'd arrest me.
You're a nightmare.
It's only if I'm in a bad mood.
So on the subject of righteousness, that's a great segue. We love a great segue here. Surge applies it in the most positive fashion.
Absolutely.
And probably has a little bit more of a leg to stand on. So let's go talk to him
instead of me. I wasn't saying I was gonna do that.
And here we go.
Fine, bye.
Our guest today is Major Serge Tadina of Imperial Beach, California, and together we're going to explain the blueprint for taking legal action against fossil fuel companies. Should your city be suing is a good question. Let's find out.
Welcome, Mayor. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So do us a favor and just tell us all who you are and what you do.
So I'm Serge Tadina, Mayor of Imperial Beach, California, which is a little 20,000 resident little blue-collar city on the U.S.-Mexico border, the southern end of California. And I'm also the executive director of Wild Coast, Costa Salvaje, a international conservation team that conserves coastal and marine ecosystems and wildlife. So one way or the other, I'm involved a lot with the ocean and coastal protection and really trying to figure out how we conserve natural ecosystems and, of course, improve the quality of life in my very super cool blue-collar beach town. I think the only one left now in Southern California.
Right. Yeah. The overlap there is certainly dwindling. So listen, so we want to set up our conversation today. Our listeners have heard this a billion times, but, you know, we're big believers in questions. And that's something that really fascinates us. But questions that don't provoke action are just philosophy. And we love philosophy. But, you know, it is a time for action. And certainly you get that. So that's where we're trying to go, what we're trying to provoke here on the podcast every day.
So what we want to do, Serge, is get some context from you. The why of you, the why of the immense change facing our listeners, and then progress to some actionable steps that that they can take. Something that will inspire them to get to work at whatever level, whatever party they subscribe to. Does that sound all right?
Yeah.
Groovy. So Mayor, we start with one important question to really get to the heart of why you're here today. And instead of that question being, what's your story or whatever, we like to ask, why are you vital to the survival of the species?
Yeah, so why am I vital? You know, it's really important to have people who can sort of see into the future in terms of understanding what's happening in the present and how that mean what that means for the future. And I think probably given my background and my family's background, that's just something that's in our DNA. And that, and you know, my parents are immigrants. My mom was bombed during the Blitz in London during the Second World War. And then my dad's family are Jewish. And my dad came to this country in 1939. My grandmother just whisked him and my uncle Roland out of their home in Paris, and then just boarded him on a boat and came to America. And that's because she had been a refugee from Poland and had her village obliterated by the Russians. And she actually lived in a village that had been obliterated by the Russians and anti-Semites for hundreds of years. And so you could just say that this idea that understanding that what's happening now may not be good for the future is something that was ingrained in me by my mom and dad and my grandmother. And I had a very momentous sort of, I guess, morning when I was a kid. I was 10 here in Imperial Beach, and my grandmother Lottie, this tiny little Jewish woman who was, it might as well have been Batman or Superman or Wonder Woman. She's like the most badass little grandma you could ever have. You did not want to get in her thing.
I had a couple of those.
Yeah, and told me the story of how she had dressed up like a man in 1938 in Paris, boarded the train for Vienna, and then had used the passports of my dad and my uncle Roland, who were a couple years younger than her niece and nephew, Lisette and Bernard, and then went and rescued them from Vienna and brought them back to Paris. My wow. dad's cousin, Bernard, my grandmother's grandson, or great-nephew, he ended up becoming a fighter in the French Resistance, and then after the war. So, you know, he was ingrained to kill Nazis, and then he worked at the Nuremberg trial. So you could say that in my family, this idea that you take action and seek justice is something we were sort of raised with, right? This idea that you're never quiet in the face of injustice, that you always, you sort of have your feelers out to sense what's coming and why it won't be, may or may not be good. And so that's sort of translated into my moving to Imperial Beach in 1971 at the age of 7, falling in love with the Tijuana Estuary, which is now a national wildlife refuge, mm-hmm. but back then was slated for development as a marina and high-rise development. And so my family quickly got involved in helping to stop that. I got beat up. It was a pretty heavy moment, you know, and a movement. But we prevailed. And so since then, I've been really involved in really sensing what's out there in terms of environmental threats and trying to deal with them and address them and fighting some pretty heavy people to make that happen. But so that's really been my story and why I think it's important to have me and other people like me out there really making sure that we're addressing these things that we're seeing on the ground now and in the water now. And we're really portend not necessarily a great future for our planet and our survival of our species.
Sure. Other species. Well, that is a hell of a unique answer.
I feel terrible for anybody who's ever run against you
or
in
your
anything.
Family. Or it sounds like your grandma specifically.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, you know, when you're raised in an immigrant family, and I find that I have this in common with other folks who are elected officials and immigrants. It's like, well, at least for me, my childhood was like equivalent of a Marx Brothers movie combined with a Seinfeld episode. And in the sense that the rules don't apply. You're not interested in following rules because you never knew what they were. Uh-huh. And your parents that have already fled the rules that were not fair. And so you've come to America and basically, you're just all about moving forward. So it's bad. It's bad when you're always awkwardly embarrassed wearing the wrong thing in the 1970s and, you know, at junior high and stuff because you didn't have any idea what, you know, normal American teenagers are supposed to look like and your parents sure don't. But also because you tend to just run over things that are in your, or steamroll things that are in your way, which can be good and bad. Not always good for human relations, but definitely helpful when you're trying to address threats to your community, to the environment, and now obviously to the planet.
Absolutely. And I thought when we first encountered you, I think is the best way to describe it, your force at the conference at UCLA, I thought I heard you describe something. Did your family take some legal action in Paris regarding the trains? Something like
yeah,
that? Or so have I totally mangled that?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. So my dad never forgot what happened to his family. And actually, I'm sitting in a room. I have a box full of the deportation orders of my dad's cousins that got sent to concentration camps.
Wow.
My dad always blamed as much the Nazis and the French government for what happened to his family. And then also the fact that he had lost his parents had lost their home and their business in Paris when they fled Europe. And so my dad signed on. There was a special commission in France to recompense and deal with the victims of people who had lost their properties and their families during this the French occupation. And so my dad went back to Paris and actually testified at the special tribunal with his cousin Lisette, who my grandmother had rescued. And he won a judgment, which is a huge deal for my dad. But he'd also signed on to a lawsuit by a really prominent attorney who was trying to sue the French railway system for basically profiting off sending Jews to their death. And the French railway system had actually charged the Nazis per, you know, seats, steerage on those trains. And so it made a profit off it. So my dad was part of that effort. It wasn't successful, but you know, nothing got in the way of my dad when he was trying to move forward. I was really proud of him for that. And I think he felt it was necessary to seek justice for his family and make sure that those wrongs were righted in some way.
Well, we can all certainly benefit and learn from your family's just, you know, history of flaming righteous social justice. It's pretty awesome. So let's talk about what's been going on. Well, I guess for about the past 50 years and take us up for today in one of my patented mangled history lessons. So, you know, we've been burning fossil fuels pretty intensely for about 100 years. It built the industrialized age and gave us the 20th century, but it also had a lot of other ramifications, some of which we're still finding out about. And we cut to July 27th, 2017, which might be a make or break date for us as a species, as a planet. Your city sued, along with two other municipalities, San Mateo and Marin. You sued 37, I believe, oil and gas companies, claiming their actions intensified climate change and exacerbated costly sea level rise. And so those companies are reportedly responsible for 20% of global carbon dioxide emissions between 1965 and 2015. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the filing here. It says, defendants have known for nearly 50 years that greenhouse gas pollution from their fossil fuel products has a significant impact on the Earth's climate and sea levels. With that knowledge, defendants took steps to protect their own assets from these threats through immense internal investment in research, infrastructure improvements, and plans to exploit new opportunities in a warming world. Defendants concealed the dangers, sought to undermine public support for greenhouse gas regulation, and engaged in massive campaigns to promote the ever-increasing use of their products at ever greater volumes. And as we've all sort of discovered through things that have been revealed from some of the biggest fossil fuel companies, they knew that that warming was going on the whole time. There were plenty of internal documents that have since surfaced and been spread online.
Yeah, and since then, a number of other cities have also sued, mostly in California, but New York as well. Paris is reportedly considering it. And you know, maybe the whole state of California will be joining that fray.
Right. And these lawsuits aren't going to stop emissions, right? Unless you start to help put these companies out of business. But in a world where we are running 40 years behind the actual emissions, feeling the effects, theoretically, it'll help to pay for adaptation, which is something we have to reckon with. And I imagine with your seaside community is something you're dealing with. So does that sort of, is that a proper context for where we are today, Mayor?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and the very real issue is, you know, I was elected mayor not to deal with sea level rise, but to actually, you know, my blue collar beach town to really do the kind of investments we need to make this a, you know, just a normal everyday city. And, you know, we had alleys that were unpaved, which is a big deal if you're in a wheelchair and you live in the back of, you know, in the, it's fronting an alley, and your kids have asthma and, you know, they have, you know, the dust, you know, makes that worse. And so, you know, put in sidewalks and crosswalks and get a grocery store. You know, we have a 25% poverty rate in my city and a third of the kids live in poverty. So, you know, we're something I'm not proud of, but, you know, we're a low-income community, working-class community next to the U.S.-Mexico border. So we have an ambitious plan, and we have been engaged in that to really put in infrastructure and really improve the quality of life of our lowest-income residents. We've been ignored for 60 years. So sea level rise, although I knew about it, and climate change, obviously very aware of it, wasn't something I was elected to deal with or even really thinking that we'd have to really address until we went along with the, we started engaging in a sea level rise planning process that was, we started carrying out, and then was really shocked to learn that, you know, as a result of sea level rise in the next, you know, the next 100 years, or by 2100, we would have probably 30 to 40% of our city impacted by coastal flooding. And I was really kind of awakened to the idea that, hey, you know, and well before this lawsuit started addressing statewide forum saying there's a difference between Malibu and Laguna Beach and Imperial Beach in that we don't have the money to do a geologic hazard district and assess our homeowners to pay for these improvement adaptation measures. We're going to be bearing the cost for things that we don't have. So it'll be, I've got to fix our coastal flooding, but at the same time, then go back to ignoring our lowest income residents. And it turns out that some of the most vulnerable areas in our city are areas where, in fact, are high, have high poverty rates and people, you know, live in low income apartment buildings, or I guess lower rent apartment buildings, which is good. But that means that we're going to have to address all those things as well. So that's why I think this lawsuit, for, it's, you know, it's not an ideological statement for us or even a political statement. It's very real.
It's necessary.
Yeah, it's necessary. We didn't cause this problem. We're suffering from it, and or we're going to suffer a lot more from it. And so therefore, those who caused it and knowingly caused it need to pay up, because my residents can't afford to. Can't afford to.
So talk to me. And like you said, before the lawsuit, you started talking on the circuit about it. How did this conversation really, to start taking legal action, how did that start for you personally?
Well, I you know, I really think it, again, you know, we started realizing what happened, became aware of this legal effort, and really discussed it. I think it was really just this idea that we need to have a mechanism to hold these companies accountable to help pay for what it would be hundreds of millions of dollars in my city to just adapt our infrastructure, not even deal with people's neighborhoods and our roads, right? And so I think that's really what it became about. And, you know, our legal team is, you know, fairly, these are really smart folks who have have really developed this sort of this legal strategy. But really for us, it's really a survival strategy. And that's why we have embraced this. And more importantly, I think even before this legal effort, we decided as a city that we were going to own sea level rise in the sense that we were going to acknowledge it, we're going to deal with it, and we're going to educate other cities and governments about the need to start planning for this now. And I think if you look at Imperial Beach and the counties of San Mateo and Marin, the first folks who signed on, and then later San Francisco, Oakland, Richmond, and Santa Cruz County and the city of Santa Cruz, we're all leaders nationally, if not internationally, on addressing the very real threats of climate change to our entities, right, to our constituents and our infrastructure. And then understanding what the cost would be. I think those are studies that we've gone through. So that's why we're on the forefront of this legal charge, because we've already been doing this already, even before the legal effort.
All right. So, you know, out of absolute necessity, obviously, legal action was taken. Talk to us about how you guys, how'd you build your case?
Because this has been something that people have tried before in vain, and it has failed. So how did you guys build this from the ground up? To know that this time might be different.
Yeah, well, I think first of all, you know, I think the legal team is really, really, I think a step above other folks who have tried this. But number two, really, is the documentation, and I think the documents that are making this case are actually come from the oil companies and fossil fuel companies themselves. So, for example, ExxonMobil donated their papers to the University of Texas. at Austin Library. I actually got my PhD in geography from the University of Texas back in the early 90s. So it actually was interesting to see that connection. But so they found these documents that outlined this, what these oil companies and fossil fuel companies were doing. And really, the crux of the argument is, not only do these companies acknowledge the impacts of climate change from their own activities and the need to change, but at the same time, they're mounting this campaign to sort of greenwash, or not greenwash, but basically cover up climate change and their own role in causing it. They were also implementing their own adaptation strategies to make sure that their own infrastructure would be resilient to sea level rise and climate change. So I think that's kind of the crux of it. It's like, you know, here you have these companies denying, knowingly denying this problem exists and creating this sort of false campaign, at the same time addressing the very real issues themselves. So I think that's what's different, is the documentation that we have, and, you know, really the smoking gun documents that are very real clear, and the whole art, you know, science of cumulative carbon, in which basically scientists can really target and understand the emissions that come from these individual companies.
Sure. And, you know, again, even aside from, I think a lot of folks, and we've helped try to help surface, you know, these documents are floating around saying they've known about it for 50 years, but which are pretty damning in themselves. But when you find documentation, like you said, that have been volunteered, that not only do they know about it, but they're preparing themselves, you know, for the repercussions of these things, it paints them into a corner, you would think. It's just, it's incredible. It's incredible. So how did this, when you guys took the leap to get on board with this thing, what was the reaction from your mayor friends?
Yeah, all the mayors just hang out, right? You guys have a big group.
Well, you know, what's funny is, I think we got a lot of support nationally, you know, at the local level. Some request, you know, constituents are, you know, doubtful of climate change, questioned it. Others were very supportive. I think what's interesting and I think for me really sad was that I was at a climate conference last year with Ed Lee, the mayor of San Francisco, who passed away not that far after I met him. And probably more than any other mayor, I'd never met him before, and I was immediately just captivated by his very folksy, down-to-earth style. And we really hit it off in terms of just being really clear, like, hey, man, we're infrastructure guys, and we've just told the engineers, he said that as well, I told my engineers, get to work and help us figure this out. Like, you could tell that he was really, really focused on it. And you know, and again, not from an ideological, political standpoint, more like, we can see these rising seas happen, and San Francisco's experienced, all the Bay Area has experienced a lot of pretty significant coastal flooding. It's pretty eye-opening, like our own city and like many cities. And so they were very focused on starting to address it. So, you know, some other mayors, though, you know, we've got some other folks in San Diego County that have told us that, oh, sea level rise is something happening to your beach city, but it's not happening to us. It's like,
yeah, that makes sense.
Sure. And my argument has been, but you know, my argument has been that if you're not, you need to start planning now, or it'll be too late.
Sure.
And I'm the chair of a regional government agency that includes all the cities in San Diego County. So we've been assisting all the coastal cities in San Diego that want to be engaged in this, in starting to plan for sea level rise in a very functional, practical way, so they can do these really plans to accommodate coastal flooding and figure out, first and foremost, how do they address it? How do they deal with it? And what's the extent of the problem? So there can be a way to address it that isn't political, it's not ideological, it's very functional, and it gets people on board to address this threat of coastal flooding. In addition to other things like, you know, now for climate change in general, you know, fires, obviously, and mudslides and all the other things that come around with our unstable climate.
What's going on? Where does the case stand today, right now? What's going on?
So you can imagine, you know, at first, you know, the companies didn't respond in terms of, you know, a flurry of activity. But now there's been a lot of activity on the part of the fossil fuel companies. You know, there's been a lot of requests for information. They tried to have this thrown to federal court. That failed. They're trying to have us deposed in Texas. And so that's something we're working on now.
Why Texas? You know,
yeah. And because ExxonMobil and other companies are in Texas. So
right.
You can only imagine that. They've got a bunch of high-priced fancy suited lawyers really spending a lot of time focused on me. Even since then, the national, you know, these scam groups that are, you know, represent so-called manufacturers and foster, major the funds for Fosterville companies and the Koch brothers have launched a campaign against me and apparently Mayor Bill de Blasio. So I'm actually pretty honored that I'm the subject of a, manufacturing troll campaign on social media. And even in the Washington Times, apparently I'm part of a giant conspiracy and that they've argued that we're part of a very large conspiracy. Apparently it's called the La Jolla conspiracy. And this has been going on for a long time. And God knows, maybe I was even born as sort of like I'm a sleeper agent designed to combat fossil fuel companies. But, you know, we're not going to underestimate these companies, desire or intent to really railroad this effort because, as you said, cities are starting to join this and maybe they're larger entities as well.
Sure. And you know, as far as you being the man with the target on your back, I am about as far from a New York Yankees fan as humanly possible. There's this great quote from Reggie Jackson where he said, fans don't boo nobodies, right. Which, I think applies. It's like they're coming after you for a reason.
Yeah, man. Congrats.
Yeah. You have to understand about Imperial Beach. We're a blue collar beach town. We don't have a lot. So, if they want to come at us, sure, go ahead. And I'm also dealing with issues related to pollution from the Tijuana River in Mexico, some of the most horrific pollution in the country, if not the planet. We've filed a lawsuit against the International Boundary and Water Commission and Veolia Water, the world's largest water company, for egregious violations of the Clean Water Act. And I'm talking about toxic waste being dumped in our watershed. And, I've gotten sick. My sons have gotten sick while surfing. Our lifeguards are getting sick. Our Border Patrol agents are getting sick. So, they can't make it any worse than that. And, someone asked about us about the risk and, the risk is not doing anything. The risk isn't challenging law, fossil fuel companies. The risk is sitting on our butts and basically ignoring this problem, just like so much of our federal bureaucracy is now being told to do.
Something interesting happened in court in San Francisco last week,
it was one of the two.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah.
Where the judge requested basically a seminar on climate science from both sides, from some of the cities involved and also from the big fossil fuel companies. Pretty unique, but at the same time, I guess, it could still go one way or the other, but feels good to know they're trying to act with science on their side. What are your thoughts on that climate science discussion that happened? Does that affect you guys at all?
Well, I think, it's a different case, but I think it definitely sets the context and probably a precedent. I think there's a lot of complex information here that needs to be studied. And I think that's probably a good thing. I think it's that makes it a lot more transparent and open and in some way democratic. So I think that was a good sign for these cases that, we're getting a fair hearing in court. Right. And, so I like that precedent. I think you're going to see a lot of new and interesting things come out of this, right? This is, an unprecedented case, not unlike the tobacco lawsuit and possibly even what will be happening with opioid lawsuits, right? You're holding these industries accountable. And so you're going to start seeing new and novel approaches to deal with this. I'm not an attorney, but, I've been impressed with the sort of legal theories and the approach in this case, but more importantly, the response of the judge, which I think appropriate. And, fair for the defendants as well. So I think that's good.
I just wanted to mention also, sort of similarly, I guess just yesterday, a federal judge in New York dismissed a lawsuit that ExxonMobil brought on to say, hey, don't let New York and Massachusetts sue us. And, the federal judge said, no, fuck that. Which again is not, not specific to your case, but must be great for all of these cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to see a lot more cities pile on. I was actually met the mayor of Paris as well at this. It was a climate meeting of mayors in Chicago in December, hosted by Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago. And so, out of that, you had San Francisco, Oakland, Santa Cruz joined on, Richmond. I was the mayor of Richmond, another ocean conference, and they signed on. So you're going to start seeing more of these lawsuits. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, people are going to say, oh, it's, you know, it's an ideological political statement. But at the end of the day, because our federal government is unwilling, it's a nightmare, but they're unwilling to acknowledge the scope of the problem we face. And we know there's no help coming. Our cities are on their own. And so they need to come up with these novel approaches, legal approaches and innovative approaches to be able to begin to identify ways to pay for these very real costs that they did not cause.
What is the best possible result from all this, you think?
Yeah, what are you specifically seeking? What are the damages you're seeking? And again, keep in mind, what we're trying to do is sort of try to help to paint a picture and build a blueprint for these folks across the U.S. and across the world that have started taking action this year across a variety of interests for maybe the first time in their lives and are pretty fired up. And we want to help build some concrete steps for them and ways they can both support you and build momentum in their own communities. Because obviously this is one that's both international, everything is connected, but also so hyper local.
Yeah. So look, the first step in that process was for us to do a sea level rise adaptation plan and really, or an impact assessment, and really identify what the specific impacts would be. And that was a sobering analysis, to look at the impacts from our infrastructure. We're surrounded on three sides by water. So we're 4 square miles with San Diego Bay on the north side of our city, the Tijuana Estuary, a national wildlife refuge, on the south side of our city, and then the Pacific Ocean to the west. So, you know, we've got some very real threats coming from three sides. And in fact, what happens with sea level rise and coastal flooding is that all of a sudden, old flood zones that have not been flooded with normal rains all of a sudden start to fill in with water. So it's even on our east side. So that was the first step. The second step was to quantify what the economic impact would be. And that would be significant, especially to the 30% of our roads that would be impacted by coastal flooding. You know, the water pipes, the sewage pipes, the storm drains, the electrical infrastructure. So all that has a really specific cost. And we're starting to already identify projects that we would carry out that would help us become more resilient. And we're talking about already tens of millions of dollars that we don't have. So that's really, I think, the first part of that process is to really go out and soberly evaluate what the impacts of sea level rise and climate change. And Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz County are filing on behalf of not just sea level rise, but the climate change impacts, because they have forests. You know, they're surrounded by forests. So I think if you look at a city like Montecito, mm-hmm. Santa Barbara County, even Los Angeles with Bel Air and those forest fires, Santa Rosa in Northern California, New Orleans, in Puerto Rico as well, obviously in Houston, Miami, all these cities that are subject to these tremendous damages from climate-related storms, then you're looking at a pretty sobering assessment of what's happening nationally and possibly even internationally with other cities. So that's the first step. And then really making sure that you have the legal wherewithal to file these cases and make your claim and really be, understanding the risks that are associated with that in terms of, legal repercussions possibly, but understanding that we have no other choice but to do this because we have no other options to pay for the types of damages that will take place.
Well, and you have to imagine that is the case over and over and over. And yes, some of these cities are inherently vastly more wealthy and resource laden on a number of fronts, whether it's purely fiscally or attorney wise or federal support or things like that. But at the same time, the bigger the city, the more shit you got to pay for. So I guess let me ask this question. The study you guys did that gave you this sobering analysis, was paying for that study in itself, was that difficult? I mean, because again, I'm trying to think of the steps that, if I go back to my hometown or someone's listening and they live in a medium-sized town and they're starting to think about, okay, when I go to my city council, I'm identifying specific steps we need to start taking to even explore potential action, not even to take action, and we want to lay those steps out for folks and build a blueprint. Talk to me about how difficult it was to both rally your council, and I don't know how the city power works in your town, and some cities are city managers versus mayor powers. How difficult was it to get that done? And then how difficult was it to pay for that just to get it going, to find out what you guys are looking at?
Yeah, I think our city was pretty open. That occurred before I was elected. So that whole process of identifying the grants. So our city identified foundation grants and some support, an agency, government agency support to pay for that planning process. So, or that economic impact and sea level rise impact analysis. So that was helpful. It was still a big process. And, you know, we had to engage our city staff in that, and then, you know, engage the public. We had a technical advisory committee of local stakeholders. You know, we're a beach community. We have a lot of folks that have been engaged in issues related to coastal protection for a long time. Really good civil engineers and scientists living in our towns. So they were heavily involved in that process. So I think that's a first step, is to identify, you know, what it will cost. And then most importantly, to get folks involved in that study who can really relate to the community. We were lucky to have a guy named Dave Revel, who has a PhD from UC Santa Cruz, and worked with a guy named Gary Griggs, who's a really renowned professor at Santa Cruz, who wrote really the sea level guidance policies for the California Coast Commission and arguably one of the world's experts on that issue. So Dave not only was a great scientist, but he fit the culture of our community. So he's able to sort of really work with our community. You know, he'd surf with us in the morning, go to meetings all day. And that was a really important part of that process. It sounds funny, but you want to have scientists that are able to communicate effectively with local stakeholders and local residents. And so we made a point of, when we did that process, to really use it as an educational process. It was happening during El Nino storms and flooding. We had a lot of coastal flooding at that time and a lot of storms. And so we really used it as an educational process. And we had one of the most highly attended meetings in our city's history. We had 400 people at a meeting to talk about coastal flooding and sea level rise. And so that became a very constructive process, right?
If I could interrupt there, that the 400 person meeting, you've mentioned that you're a pretty blue collar town. I have to imagine that all of those 400 people weren't necessarily in agreement on action.
Well, you know, so there's the first thing is just identifying what the impact. So really we were coming up with a whole range of possible actions. Really what the point of that was to really identify what the impacts would be and how much it would cost, and then to educate them about that. Sure. So, and this is the quandary that everyone's going to be facing. And that's something I've realized, you know, I do conservation work for a living. So I spend a lot of time thinking about how you communicate conservation and environmental values and issues to, you know, local audiences and broad audiences. And I think the issue here, though, in terms of educating people about the impact and what to do and how much it's going to cost, is that, you know, let's all be honest, we're not used to thinking about what's going to happen in 100 years. We're not used to thinking about what's going to happen in 100 days or even 100 hours, right? And so that getting those ideas and concepts across to people is something that you can't do just in a meeting or in one process or the plan. That's going to be an ongoing educational process and really evolving work strategy to really, and then an educational strategy. So when these events happen, you can really educate people, okay, this is what happened, this is why it happened, and really do it effectively. The one thing that we did, and I think if you look at whether it's New Orleans or Newport News, Virginia, where they're doing these types of processes, is no one's really talking about sea level rise as much as we're talking about coastal flooding. Everyone can pretty much right. get signed coastal flooding, and they can see it happen. And so that's what I think it was good about our process. It was very practical. We didn't focus a lot on the science of climate change, even though we did talk about it. We were very open about it. We really wanted to get the meat and potatoes of, we're surrounded on three sides by water. We can see this flooding happening now. This is what's projected to happen in the future. So let's rally together to figure out how to deal with this. But the how to deal with it in terms of what adaptation measures you take is going to be some of the tough stuff. And there's some just tough decisions we're going to have to make. But in the meantime, what we came up with, and I think our residents can rally behind, and this is a tragedy of a Congress and a president that can't understand infrastructure. People love infrastructure programs. The purpose of government, in my opinion, is to help obviously care for the health and safety of our residents. And a lot of that has to do with infrastructure. So when you say, hey, look, man, we've got a lot of flooding that's coming along now. We need to move a water line. We have a storm drain. Let's help a school adapt to that. Let's figure out what to do with our roads. That's something that people can get up behind. They, you know, we have a lot of retired military in our community. San Diego is a big Navy town, and we're at the south end of San Diego. So that was a way to frame it. I think that's a really successful strategy. And, you know, I've talked to everyone from people in the Navy to folks from the Dutch government and folks from New Orleans. And I think that's what they all say is the more practical you are, the less sort of like, let's hit you over the head with our ideological point of view or a point of view and really get you to really accept the way we think about things versus the practical nuts and bolts approach to dealing with coastal flooding and sea level rise. I think that's really the way that we get the community engaged.
Well, and that seems to be the model and has, you know, been the most successful model throughout human history is what can I see and touch and feel with my own hands and storytelling versus, as we've clearly seen in the past year and a half, you know, the science isn't cutting it.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of nerds who love science and they'll argue that all day, but it's just not effective versus telling people, showing them a picture of, like you said, coastal flooding versus sea level rise and saying, hey, that's your house, Jim, right? In that red area on this image on the slide projector. You know, that's your house and that's your Susie, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, get your head out of your ass, Jim.
And you know, really trying to help paint that picture to tangible things that people can understand. Because it, you know, that's what's going to move the needle. It's hard to say you have to apply to people's best interests, but that's it. If you want to get them involved when there's so much else going on and so much else that's distracting, to make them think about something that's going to happen in 20, 50, 100 years. But like you said, in places like there, like where you are, looking at the new studies on, you know, San Francisco Airport, Oakland Airport are in deep shit. I'm from Virginia. I have spent a large part of my life about 15 minutes away from Newport News. I know very well what they're facing in the naval base there. You know, you have to paint that picture for people to really get them involved.
You know, even still, there are going to be a lot of tough decisions. You know, those folks in Montecito with, you know, the mudslides, or folks in Bel Air, you know, they're not going to want to move, or folks in Houston. And, you know, we're really good at responding to threats. We're not so good at preventing threats. And I think that's where we have to move the needle, is really going back to saying, okay, let's all work together. Let's at least take the lowest hanging fruits in terms of floodplain management. And my argument too is we've got all these watersheds and wetlands. Let's restore them to their full capacity. So at least we can use those. That's the first line of defense in terms of natural climate solutions. And so that's something we've also been working on, is really focused on. We've got some areas that can be even more resilient in terms of converting a salt flat and mud flat into fully functioning wetlands. So we'll do that, even making our watershed that feeds into our community a healthier ecosystem. And that's what we've also been preaching to cities across the county of San Diego, at least on the coastline, is, hey, here are some practical things you can do. And I think this issue of natural climate solutions, and, you know, that's the other way of looking now at conservation. It's not just about, you know, conservation for its own sake, but it's, hey, these are the most cost-effective adaptation measures you can take. They don't really cost you that much to conserve the open space around your city or your entity in the first place.
Sure. So what else do you feel is transferable to other cities, regardless of size, other municipalities that haven't taken action yet?
Let's summarize the process. So the process really is, and let's go even before that. One of the things that California's been really great at is doing, there's a whole King Tide program. So we're actually, there's a whole citizen science monitoring project where people are going out and documenting king tides. I think it's going on in a lot of coastal areas in the United States. So that isn't, if you're in a coastal city and you're not, no one's doing that, that's a good first step to start documenting these rising tides. And, you know, and more severe king tides, those are the highest tides of the year. So that's the first step. The second step, obviously, is to do this impact study, sea level rise or climate change impact study. The third step is to really identify the economic impact of that. And then the fourth step that we've taken is now we're incorporating that impact analysis into our general plan or California local coastal plan. So we're incorporating that into the legal underpinning and planning underpinning of our city. So that's a big step, and we're engaged in that now. But I think those are really the tangible steps, and every city can do that. Every entity can do that. And it doesn't have to be as painful as people think. If we get around, really, it's a hazard study. It's a natural risk study, and from the risk of fire, you know, flooding, sea level rise, and obviously now mudslides.
Sure. And you know, one would think once all that is complete, you can take a pretty good step back and say, well, we can either afford this or we fucking can't. And someone is going to have to pay for it. And even if we can afford it, should we be the ones paying for this?
Right.
And is it going to get exponentially worse? If I'm a voter in one of these towns, and again, we kind of encourage people to either go to your first city council meeting, and if they don't listen to you, run for city council yourself. But how would you specifically encourage citizens to go and talk with their mayors and city councils? What are they going to, how are they going to start these conversations at a meeting if it's not happening from the authority side?
Well, I think that the most effective way of doing it is saying, hey, look, we have a situation of changing climate instability. We've seen these record floods. We've seen these fires. We've seen these mudslides. Do we have a strategy for addressing it? And more importantly, how are we going to pay for it? And I think framing it that way is a way that becomes an inclusive strategy of, hey, let's help. How are we going to prepare for the future? And then number two, how are we going to pay for it? I would argue that most mayors and most city councils are, like me, are pretty obsessed, at least if you live in an area that's, you know, surrounded by nature and impacted by, you know, climate and subject to these natural hazard risks, is that you're probably spending a lot of time focused on things like this, or you're, at least like me, you're worried about it all the time. I'm not worried about what ExxonMobil is going to do for us legally. I'm sure worried about the dam upstream in Tijuana that could break, or frankly, giant storms with 15 to 25 foot surf and 6 foot of storm surge. That's what keeps me up at night, is worrying about that. So I think that is probably one of the most effective strategies, so that it becomes really about a policy process and something that people can get behind, rather than, hey, you know, I'm really worried about climate change and what are you going to do about it? But more about, hey, these other cities and entities are doing this type of process. Can we think about that here?
Yeah, I mean, the more specific, the better, certainly. And especially if you can point to your neighbors and say, hey, look.
Sure. And that seems to be one of the places where hopefully we can find common ground. And, you know, we had a whole sort of series of conversations with the rare white fox conservative climate activists who are coming at it from different levels and why they want to do and why it matters. But the point is, they're on board with the science at this point and trying to make the hardest fight, which is to, and we're very thankful to them, to convince that last contingent that it matters. And we've kind of come to the opinion here that, you know, whatever the means are that justify the end at this point, whatever the hell gets people on board, and it does seem to be making it specific. And it does seem to be saying, like, you know, Mitch Hescock said, you know, go back to the Bible. And they said, it specifically tells us to take care of the earth. So we need to do that. And, or it could come down to your principles on regulations versus taxes. But the point is the more specific you can make it to these folks. And again, dialing it down to the level of looking around in your community and saying, even looking around in that meeting and saying, how many of us are affected by what's on this slide and what we've seen, you know, or what preparations have we made to deal with mudslides? What have, you know, for river overflows? I mean, gosh, there was an incredible study that came out a couple months ago about the river system in the U.S. and how many are going to be prone to flooding in the next 50 years. And it's just shocking. So anybody who's in middle America who thinks they're not going to be affected by climate change is just wrong. I mean, there are these great vast bodies of water that are going to be fucked.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what it comes down to is most folks who spend time outside, you know, I'm outside all the time. I'm, you know, like an animal on the beach sniffing changes in the air. And
you're a big surfer, right?
Yeah. Surfers are, you know, we detect with our noses and our eyes, you know, micro changes in swell and wind, and more importantly, seasonal changes. And, you know, things are all over the map. Everyone's saying, you know, nothing is like it used to be. And I'm sure that's the same for farmers, ranchers, fishermen. People are outside on the ground. If you're in the Rocky Mountains, you can see the changes in forest cover. And, you know, you can feel the temperature changes. I was just down in Oaxaca in southern Mexico on a surf trip, and where I work professionally with Wild Coast. But, you know, you've talked to farmers there and fishermen, and they just know that everything's changed there in terms of when the rains come and when they don't come and temperature. So I think folks are starting to feel those changes. And I think if it's, you know, I try to be an optimist, but if people don't get the response they think they should have, then they should run for city council. That's why I ran. I was discouraged by our former administration and the person that was running our city and said, I think I can do a better job and bring people together around a lot of common things and work together. And so I ran a grassroots campaign and knocked on 5,000 doors and won by 43 votes. And it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. And it's been a significant positive change for our community because we've gotten people engaged in the governing process and helping to make decisions about these tough questions that we're asking.
Yeah, and there seems to be a pretty great tie to that. And so many organizations that, and again, we've said it before here, which is like, you know, the current administration and everyone they've brought onto the team, they've actually brought anyone onto their team, is a nightmare, but in some ways has been this incredible catalyst for so many groups and folks to spring up that have never before interacted or acted in any way with the system, you know, whether it's, the female-led group Run for Something or 500 Women Scientists or 314 Action. There just seems to be a big communal rally, but also a sense of, and what we're desperately trying to encourage a lot of folks to just say, I didn't get the answer I wanted. Fuck it. I'll do it myself. And, you know, if that's the mantra that gets it done, then that's what we got to do.
Yeah. And I think the more that people can be collaborative, consensus driven, and, you know, at some point on in terms of making things happen. And, you know, it's hard. It isn't easy to deal with people who don't believe in infrastructure or even solving problems and use government to actually dismantle things. That's not an easy process to be a part of. And that's why they have to help, you know, create that change at the local level. And at the local level, people want representatives who care about their neighborhoods, who can communicate with them in a respectful way. And I'd say people are generally less ideological. And I think that's a good platform for people to have a very sober view of, hey, let's all plan for the future and let's think about how we can do that together. And so, you know, I tend to be idealistic, but, you know, that's my job, is to be a professional optimist. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't get anything done.
Mayor, what are the biggest obstacles that you're running into? And, you know, what should folks who want to fight the good fight watch out for and prepare for?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's, you know, you're going to have a lot of folks out in the community that are professional pessimists who say there is nothing you can do. You can't fight these powers. It's right. Too risky. You know, a lot of folks in government now are, you know, I've just noticed this, whether in the bureaucracies or elected officials, are sort of like paralyzed by fear. And we've got to get beyond that. And I think we've recognized now that if you want to get anything done, government has to be a lot more innovative. It has to be able to move a lot more quickly. And that goes against the grain of what, and many times, local governments and agencies stand for. But, you know, the future is changing so rapidly that you have to move with it instead of against it.
Yeah,
so I think,
afford not to.
You know, and really to sort of just be able to move beyond the professional pessimism and to sort of start saying, okay, you know, we've got these issues. How are we going to address them? They're not going to go away just by making, you know, people making arguments saying climate change doesn't exist, doesn't work anymore, because everyone knows that the climate is changing. They can see it. They can see this unstable climate patterns happening in these weather events that just frankly haven't happened before.
Sure. They're just become very exasperated. And this is a good moment to mention, because it's been highlighted so much across so many issues lately. Thoughts and prayers aren't cutting it anymore. We just can't rely on that. We've got to take action at some point, even if it starts with basic questions and basic explorations.
Yeah. All right. We're getting close to time here. Really appreciate you being here, Mayor. Thank you very, very much. Anybody else we should talk to?
Yeah. You know, I think
who inspires you? Who's getting it done, or who should we challenge?
You know, I like the folks in Marin and San Mateo. I'd be interested to talk to San Francisco. New York City is doing some interesting things, and you know, they're looking at some pretty massive adaptation measures they have to take to prevent the coastal flooding. You know, the kind of storms that my nightmares are about happened recently with these Northeasters in Massachusetts and the whole Eastern Seaboard. And when I see what's happening there, I cringe to think, oh my God, you know, we haven't had those types of storms since El Nino storms in the 1980s and maybe 1990s, but they're coming. And so I think it'd be interesting to talk to those folks and, you know, folks on the Gulf Coast or even Puerto Rico about what they're experiencing and how they're going to deal with that or not deal with it. I think maybe Houston would be a sobering analysis about how, you know, we're very willing to spend billions of dollars to reconstruct, but very little to prevent. So I think those are the types of things that I'm looking at. And even more so, folks in the military who are engaged in sea level rise adaptation and climate change planning, they won't call it that. But the military is very engaged in addressing sea level rise and risk assessment and impact and addressing their infrastructure to deal with it in a very practical way. So that might be, they actually have a very close relationship with the Navy. We're surrounded by Navy bases. And
sure.
There's a $1 billion special warfare complex for the SEAL team being built on the north edge of our town. They're moving operations out of a very flood vulnerable area in Coronado, California, and moving it to this area that's the highest area on the coast. And they're not putting anything in the flood zone. The only thing they have in the flood zone is one building that's actually built to withstand flooding. And they won't call it sea level rise adaptation, but they definitely are prepared for climate change and coastal flooding.
Sure. All right. So let's summarize, and you've done an excellent job of doing that for us. So thank you. What our listeners and sort of progressives in general and everyone needs to can do to take action. So as a citizen, it's look yourself, don't put your head in the sand, look yourself and then talk to your community and your leaders about the other devastating impacts are happening everywhere else. And there's such a wide variety of them now. And like you said, things that weren't happening before or things that have been exacerbated, you know, like they've said, the hurricanes are just wetter than they've ever been before. You know, number two is ask your leaders, do we have a strategy when these things come to town, once you've sort of identified what your biggest risks might be? And then three, how are we planning to pay for it? And then as a city council member or mayor, do an initial exploration of potential impacts. Like you said, it's a hazard report. It might not be sea level rise, it's coastal flooding. Get a technical advisory community, get folks involved in the study who can specifically contribute, leaders in your area or at least your region who might know it better than most. And ID key models and things to look about. So help folks understand that we sort of for the first time have to look ahead 50, 100 years, which humans are just not necessarily good at. Again, frame it as coastal flooding versus sea level rise. Less about the science, more about the tangible impacts and then the plans and what we can do about them. Look at specific things like king tides that have been proven now to be getting worse. And then explore the economic impact. Like you said, everything from pipes to electrical to infrastructure. In which is standard in most cases. And then you start to run into places like you said, San Diego or Norfolk, which are obviously just exceptional situations, like have such an international impact. And then ID projects that you would carry out if funded, which could be tens of millions of dollars. You know, how many communities can afford to do that or should afford to do that? And what are at the same time, the most cost-effective measures you can take in the meantime? And overall, just make it personal, make it tangible, make it something that is necessary now. Did I do a good job there? Did I mangle that? Is there anything else I'm missing?
No, I think I think it's a great summary. And you know, and get at some level, you know, you got to get the infrastructure geeks and the weather geeks and the climate geeks involved in this, in the sense of understanding that, hey, they can actually have a big impact in learning to work collaboratively, learning to find common ground with people. And, you know, we're all attuned to threats. That's how we learn to communicate as humans, based on discussing threats, right? That was the initial sort of ways that we communicated. And so I think this is good practice for the future. And more importantly, we can't afford not to do it. So the more that we practice doing it, the more we try to do it, the more successful we'll have.
Rock and roll. Sounds awesome. All right. We have a last few questions for you. It's a little bit of a lightning round that we do with everybody. Sound good?
Sure. Sounds great.
Okay. So the first one is, and you've certainly gone into this, and it goes back into your family history, because you guys have been taking on the man for centuries, it sounds like.
Damn the man.
Well, when was the first time in your life when you realized you had the power of change or the power to do something meaningful personally? And you can't just rely on your grandma here. I'm talking about you.
Yeah, you know, we moved to Imperial Beach, California in 1971, and we fell in love with the Tijuana Estuary, and then quickly realized that it was going to be turned into a marina and high-rise condos. And so I wrote my first letter to the newspaper at the age of 7, and calling really and saying that I really valued this place and we should preserve it. So I think that was the first real action I'd ever taken, and that initiated a lifelong sort of obsession with trying to make a difference and making the world a better place.
Oh yeah. Awesome. All right. Question number two, how do you get your news? How do you consume the news?
Yeah, I'm online. I'm getting, you know, everything online from the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, different blogs and email newsletters. So, and in English and Spanish, you know, I work in Mexico and Latin America. So just consuming a lot of mainstream news, and then more in tune, sort of fine tune climate related stuff. I follow a lot of folks on Twitter who either work with NOAA or the National Weather Service or climate scientists. I love the blue carbon folks in Australia doing some really innovative research on blue carbon. So that's kind of like my geekyism. And, you know, I do biodiversity conservation for a living. So I'm doing a lot of following folks that are doing some interesting science based on biodiversity research and, more importantly, climate adaptation and especially blue carbon now.
Nice. Awesome. Hey, I want to run back to that last question real quick. I realized I should have asked you this. What happened with that letter that you wrote the paper about the estuary?
Yeah, you know, it was published in our local paper back when, you know, there were three newspapers in our small city. And, you know, that was really the part of a movement that culminated when I was 15 or 16 in helping preserve the T1 estuary. So my entire childhood was spent writing letters and at one point sitting in front of bulldozers and getting beat up, but involved in the political process to help save a place that me and my family loved.
Awesome. All right. We love this one, Serge. If you could Amazon Prime one book to Donald Trump, what would that book be?
It's Homo Deus. I'm reading it recently. It's Homo Deus, which is a really interesting book, really about really trying to think about the origins of this nature sort of people split.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a fantastic book.
Yeah. Yuval Noah. So it's really interesting. And
same guy who wrote Sapiens.
Yeah, and obviously I read Sapiens as well, which also started getting me think about this idea of, and you mentioned it, obviously, storytelling and the way we communicate and how we communicate. I think it's been really, really important. And obviously Donald Trump doesn't
read,
so maybe some sort of reality show. You know, I think a reality show set in the bayou, about with all kinds of interesting people, and all of a sudden there's a flood and climate change, and maybe that's the way to do it. It's reality TV.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, whatever the means are to get to the end, we'll do it. Whatever the thing is.
Yeah. A fake Fox News network that all of a sudden is on board with climate change.
Right. It's like our Argo, basically. Mayor, we can't thank you enough for your time here. If you've said so much and we appreciate you fighting every day. If there's anything else you want to say to our listeners, speak truth to power, that you want to get out there and inspire these folks to put their iPhone down, stop listening to the podcast, and go run for city council. What would that be?
You know, there's nothing more impressive than persistence, than dogged persistence and patience and willing to just keep moving forward. That will get you across the finish line. And in the end of the day, that's what makes change. And it's not sexy. It's not on Twitter. It's not social media. It's the power of human relationships and really getting people to work together for a common goal. And I'm very, very, very much believe that that's the approach we have to take, and the approach is going to win.
Rock and roll. Hey, where can we follow you online? Where can our listeners follow you?
At Serge Dedina.
That's Twitter, yeah?
Yeah. That's the best place.
Rock and roll.
Well, Mayor, thank you so much again. We really appreciate both your time today and for all that you do in the world. We hope you keep kicking ass out there. Look forward to meeting you soon. We're just north of you up in LA most of the time here. So we'll have to get it on the books. And again, yeah, thank you. We are depending on you, and thank you for leading the way in this fight.
Great. Thank you so much. We really had a really nice time with the conversation.
Awesome. Yeah. Glad we made this happen. Thank you very much.
Thanks to our incredible guest today. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. We hope this episode has made your commute or awesome workout or dishwashing or fucking dog walking late at night that much more pleasant. As a reminder, please subscribe to our free email newsletter at importantnotimportant.com. It is all the news most vital to our survival as a species.
And you can follow us all over the internet. You can find us on Twitter at importantnotimp.
Just
so weird. Also on Facebook and Instagram at Important Not Important, Pinterest and Tumblr, the same thing. So check us out, follow us, share us, like us, you know the deal. And please subscribe to our show wherever you listen to things like this. And if you're really fucking awesome, rate us on Apple Podcasts. Keep the lights on. Thanks.
Please.
And you can find the show notes from today right in your little podcast player and at our website, importantnotimportant.com.
Thanks to the very awesome Tim Blaine for our jamming music, to all of you for listening, and finally, most importantly, to our moms for making us. Have a great day.
Thanks, guys.